Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Hello, everyone. Could everyone take their seats and silence their phones? Do all those audience protocol things you know full well to do. I'm Clara Jeffrey. I'm the editor-in-chief of Mother Jones. And yay! Which is the sponsor for this panel and several others at this amazing festival. I'm here tonight with someone I've known and been a fan of for many years. Barbara Ehrenreich is a distinguished essayist and the author of many books, including Nickel and Dimed and now Natural Causes, which examines the ways in which we obsess over death, our bodies, and health. And she's going to take on wellness in the heart of wellness. She's won national magazine awards, including for an investigation in a corporation selling dangerous products abroad for Mother Jones, and Welcome to Cancer Land for Harper's, which I had the pleasure of editing there. She's been on many boards of journalistic institutions, as well as the Democratic Socialists of America and Normal. I'd like to welcome Barbara. Yay! So let's just jump right into one of the main thrusts of this book. What made you decide to stop getting medical tests, and how did that inform your examination of the medical profession?
Okay, first let me say something nice about Clara, because you were not, you skimped over some things. Clara was my editor for something I wrote for Harper's in, I don't even remember what year, 2000?
1990.
No, 2000, I don't know, which was about my experience working in low-wage jobs in Florida. And she was my editor, and it turned into a 12,000-word piece in Harper's, which created kind of a sensation or something, and I got a book contract, and then I went on from there to do Nickel and Dimed, my best-selling book. And then I want to say about Mother Jones, going way back before your time, it was the first place I kind of regularly wrote for in my youthful days. So I'm very pleased to be here with her. So why did I decide to give up medical testing? This is not a suicidal decision. I want to make that clear. It's funny, people always ask me that, and they say, did you tell your children? Yeah. But they could see it coming. Because over the years, I began to I saw that when you turn 50, or well before that, you begin to be requested, urged, almost forced into more and more kind of preventive screenings. And, you know, at first I kind of went along with it uneasily. I had a bone density scan. Turned out I had a disease, actually, osteopenia, which means that your bones are getting a little weak, and it's a disease that almost all women over menopause have. So I thought, oh, come on, you know. That's not a disease at all. It's just a condition of being a woman and growing older. And after that, I began to do more and more research on each test as it was pushed on me and rejected them rationally. See, it's easy. You know, just do enough Googling, even very little Googling, and you can find out that there is terrific controversy over some of the basic ones.
So which were some of the ones that you, I remember when we were working on Welcome to Cancer Land, you were suspicious far before many of sort of how preventative mammograms were being used to basically diagnose things that weren't yet cancer, although you did have cancer.
Yeah, and mine did not need a mammogram to be diagnosed, but I began to be suspicious. Mammograms are an interesting case. I know women who will defend their right to an annual mammogram to the death. But the statistical basis for that is not that good. When you look at it, you find that that ours is a very mammogram conscious country, does a lot more than a lot of other countries, but we do not have a lower mortality rate for breast cancer. And so it seems kind of crazy often to Europeans how invested we are in this procedure. But I decided that the evidence was sort of, it was controversial, and I at a certain point, I was just going to forego them.
And this became a pretty big controversy about a year ago, as I recall, when maybe it was the ACA or other medical boards recommended not giving annual mammograms to women under the age of 50, I think. And many people got very upset, and including members, I think it was Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who had been diagnosed fairly young, who really went to the wall for keeping that standard.
Who's she?
She's best known for other scandals, but...
okay. there was actually a little protest on a highway in the D.C. area in front of the building where this decision was made. But I think there's got to be a better way than mammograms. Mm-hmm. I mean, mammograms are somewhat violent procedures. You know, attempts to render one's breasts transparent by brute force, you know, making them as thin as pancakes. And then I'm not trying to stop anybody else from doing this. Let me be very clear about that. I just decided after a mammogram, which turned out to be a, quote, bad mammogram, which terrified me since I'd already had cancer, weeks went by because I couldn't get hold of my doctor, and I was really, really, really upset. Turned out it was only a bad mammogram because they were using a new digital form of mammography, which had many more false positives. At that point, I thought, that's my last mammogram. I'm not doing this, you know, going through that.
So have you foregone all kind of medical testing, or is it sort of the annual screening or the age-indicated screenings that you...
Well, the annual exam has been rejected by the important groups like the United States Preventive Health Services Task Force. It's a farce. It does nothing. You're going to live no longer if you have it. Same with the annual pelvic exam. It is an ugly, and I would say, creepy ritual. Just leave it alone. So, yeah, no, what I said when I had to get a new doctor because the old one kind of disappeared, not my fault, but I got a new doctor and I just said to her straight up, I will come to you if anything is bothering me. But don't go looking for problems. We're not doing that. There is no way that they will not find a problem if they look hard enough and do enough scans. And then you're down the rabbit hole of further testing, further exams, and so on.
So you've made this decision in your 70s. Do you think if you knew then what you know now, would you have made the same decision when you were in, say, your 30s or 40s?
Well, I wouldn't have had the same experiences then, so I can't say that I would have. But I'm seeing younger women make the same decision, too. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what's going on with age in this. Mm-hmm. But in my case, it matters. Suppose I have a mammogram. They say, you have breast cancer. Now we begin the chemo and the radiation. Say, sorry. I don't have time for that. I don't. If I have 4 years to live, I'm not spending two of them in a state of, you know, the toxic condition where you're rendered into by chemotherapy.
Right. In kind of critiquing the annual physical, I've heard that there's actually, in some ways, kind of a return to that because it's less about, you know, getting your blood pressure indicator and your reflexes measured and all that kind of stuff, and more just like the only chance you have in a modern medical facility to kind of bond over time, hopefully with one doctor that you like. Is it the testing part of that ritual that you object to? If you just go talk to a doctor once a year, would do you think there's value in that?
Don't you have any other friends?
Do you like doctors, Barbara?
Don't you know of anybody to talk to? This is an argument actually that's coming now from some noted doctors they're saying it's a ritual, the stuff we've been doing. It's a ritual, but it's important for bonding, for creating a relationship. I'm sorry, I don't want a relationship with you. If I'm bleeding, I want you to stitch it up and so forth. But that whole idea of what we're selling is a relationship is terrifying. And if I do have a relationship with a professional in some basis, it's not going to be one in which it starts with me taking my clothes off. All right?
Good to know. As I said before, you've kind of come to at least one of the epicenters of wellness, Berkeley, California, to critique the very notion of wellness. But I want to ask just for you to define what that word means to you.
Okay, wellness. Now, this is what it means in the world. I should first make a Berkeley comment. I just had a cheeseburger in Berkeley at this place called Eureka, and it was great. But I couldn't believe that. I'm eating a cheeseburger here. So wellness really has two meanings by class. If you are an ordinary employee in a company, your company may bring in a, quote, wellness program. That does not mean sweetness and kindness. That means that they are going to start monitoring, usually your weight. They're obsessed with weight, maybe blood pressure. You have to opt into this, or you'll be penalized financially by your company. And they're tracking your weight, and they can bring you in and say, what's this? We see a 7-pound change, blah, 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 blah. That should not be part of an employee-employer relationship. That's simple surveillance of the workers, period. But there's another kind of wellness, which is all sweetness and light. And that's more what you have in Berkeley, which is a rich people's thing. And this is about taking care of yourself in really nice ways. Rubbing things onto your skin, inhaling things, having hot rocks placed on your body. I cannot remember. There's a lot of things like being wrapped in seaweed. And that you come out.
It's detoxifying.
It was fun?
I'm kidding.
You said it was fun?
Detoxifying, supposedly.
Huh?
Detoxifying, supposedly.
Detoxifying.
Yeah, I just wanted to get in your craw a little bit more.
Yeah, this thing about detoxifying, I'm sorry that we don't, we have livers that try to take care of the toxins that we ingest. Whoops. I didn't mean it, whatever I said about Berkeley. But there is no, there's this idea in the wellness culture that we are being bombarded by filth and toxins, and that we have to purify ourselves. Now, what they really mean by filth and everything is the rest of us. That's where the dirt ultimately comes from. Food is not toxic, generally, unless it's been poisoned by some enemy of yours. But that's all nonsense. There are no toxins to remove. It's all about self-nurturance. And the more you spend on it, the more you are showing how much you love yourself. Now, I know that's a big theme in all the alternative modalities, loving yourself. I think it's ridiculous. who is the self that does the loving, and who is the self that is loved? I can't I can't bifurcate myself in that way.
So if I could boil this down, correct me if I'm wrong, but you think at least on the upper income spectrum of this, it's both kind of a strange form of narcissism and a kind of conspicuous consumption that's less conspicuous, but there, nonetheless.
Oh, yeah. And you can be conspicuous about your wellness. I read it in, there are a lot of luxury wellness publications, luxury wellness spas around the world. I mean, there is a wellness industry now. And I read in some of the literature that if you just want to display your wellness, you can walk around with a yoga mat in a special carrier, I don't know what they're called, and with a bottle of some green fluid. That'll do it.
But what's so wrong with, you know, people taking care of themselves or even pampering themselves? I mean, I feel it actually in the last couple of years I've seen some of the kind of strongest evocations of self-care from black women on Twitter who are very much like, you know, I need to carve out a space given what our community is up against and sort of talking about. So, it, you know, is it all this sort of endless cesspool of self-regard, or is there a need for people to kind of recharge and, you know, take care of themselves in some kind of way?
Yeah, well, in real life, you know, I'm constantly telling friends, take a little time for yourself, take it easy, have some fun, you know, that is separate from what you do.
Yeah. Now, you take on gym culture, but by the end of the book, you reveal that you're still going to the gym a lot. So what part is the part that you don't like versus the part that you do find invigorating or satisfying in some way?
Oh, well, I began to see my time in the gym as kind of anthropological field work. It's really interesting to watch. I mean, and this, too, is a class thing. Gyms are not for manual laborers. They are not for people who cannot pay the fee to join the gym. So I got really into it. I am ashamed to say I became very competitive. I became a show-off in the gym. You can't see the muscles because I'm dressed, but I went too far, in fact. That's why I have a cane now. I wrecked my back. But the interesting thing to me was this kind of dualism that goes on. You're fighting yourself in the gym. Originally, it seemed to be kind of like a nice thing to do, but the language has changed. For example, now you're there to crush your body. And then the latest class that they added at my gym is called shredding your body, which something, you know, sounds like The Walking Dead. I mean, there's a kind of a fascinating, again, dualism. Can I conquer my physical body? And I got into that. I still, you know, I go. I don't think it's an evil thing to do, and I like bodybuilding.
Do you see a difference between that and, say, someone who is going out hiking or, you know, bike riding, either at a very high level or in a kind of, you know, more lackadaisical level? Like, is it a difference in effort, or what part is the sort of the thing about the culture that as a you know, anthropologist you got into?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I like hiking. I like bike riding. I don't, you know. It's just the gym kind of concentrates that obsession with my own body. Mm-hmm. And everybody else is obsessed. You're there. That's why you're there. You know.
So you got a PhD in cellular biology, which I'd forgotten about before reading this book. And you seem to draw a particular insight from something you once studied, the macrophages. Can you explain what those are and what you think that they are teaching us about the sort of larger view of health?
Oh, my favorite subject, macrophages. You probably came to hear about that, right? Right? Everybody's here for macrophages. Good. See, what I I began to conclude about all these things we're doing in an effort to prolong our lives, is that they're not going to do that much. The dietary stuff, I mean, I can't keep up with it. There's no way I could keep up, or anybody could keep up with the changes in that from day to day. The exercise, and I think that I have some faith in that. The medical testing, not at all. That finally we have to recognize we cannot control our bodies. We cannot control everything that goes on in them. And my case study in that, I should say that the whole idea of controlling it is what infuses the alternative medical modalities, that your conscious mind can control everything else if you just, you know, think the right thoughts or, you know, open yourself to what's going on with your cells and so on. And what that is based on is sort of a theory of the body as a harmonious whole. You know, there are different things, there are different parts, but it's all harmonious and beautiful and holistic, right? Yes, say right. And what that clearly leaves out is the number of diseases and ailments that come from our bodies being, parts of our bodies being at war with other parts. Cancer, for example. Yeah, there are a lot of cancers that are environmentally caused and things like that we can figure out. But cancer is basically a rebellion. A cell, or maybe two or three cells, somewhere in your body said, hey, we're enough of this hanging out and doing our work here. You know, because the cell, you know, we like to think of the body as a communist dictatorship. Every cell does its job loyally, whatever it's told to do. But cells can say, enough of that. Let's just go out and take over this whole place. We can do it. That's what cancer is. Now, what I learned that kind of changed my life mentally, and it's not that long ago I learned it, is that, in fact, parts of our immune system aid cancers, help them spread. The macrophages, for example, are the frontline attack cells of the immune system. Our buddies, right? They fight bacteria. I studied them because they're such good guys when I was in graduate school. No cancer can metastasize without their help. They kind of gently lead cancer cells into the blood system so they can go around and colonize other places. Now, I don't know. You know, philosophically, to me, that is amazing. And I would like to see some philosophy of science writing about it.
So it's this notion of almost betrayal that you get at, that these phages, or we have a piece coming out in this, or out in the issue right now that's on phage therapy for specific infections. So they can be used for good medical ends.
Oh, yeah.
But you're saying that somehow with cancer they betray us in a way.
And not only cancer, I mean, so many things. What is an autoimmune disease? So that's the immune system, with macrophages at the front line, deciding they don't like some organ in the body and they're going to destroy it. And they do that and they kill people. All the ailments that go with aging, from arthritis to what else are we experiencing? Even diabetes are mediated by the immune system, and to the point that, I mean, you've all heard how much of our problems, especially as we get older, are from inflammatory events in our body. What does inflammatory mean? It means the immune system going a little nuts and attacking. So even cardiovascular disease is inflammatory in nature and mediated by macrophages.
You know, towards the end of the book, you really exhort people to stop worrying about death and decline and celebrate, you know, the joy of life, the sort of quantum fluctuations of the universe. And it actually reminded me of a little bit of one of the Madeleine L'Engle books, I think it was Wind in the Door, where the kids, Megan, Charles, Ryan, and those kids are like in the forest of mitochondria, and they're like going down
What book is it?
Do you remember the most famous one is A Wrinkle in Time, but that continuation of her series, where they kind of go into the, you know, go into the cells itself. But anyway, it was a quite beautiful chapter. And in some ways, departure from more acerbic parts of the book. And I'm wondering if, in writing this book, was it a sort of journey of acceptance of mortality for yourself, or had you already kind of come to this conclusion and then written the book?
The conclusion that I might die?
Well, the acceptance of that.
You know, I think it's just amazing. Tomorrow I'll be in Portland, and the guy who I'll be in co-conversation with, like you, he called me, we were talking on the phone, he said, Barbara, you're so mean, I've read your book and it says I'm going to die. I mean, what are people thinking? Yeah. I had a saw an optometrist recently, he said, you know, in a few years, you might need cataract surgery. And I said in my usual glib way, oh, in a few years, maybe I'll be dead. And he said, you're not going to die. And I said, oh, yeah, I am. And he insisted, no, you're not going to die. And I said, so are you. And at that point, he said, well, everybody is. And that was the end of the conversation. Well, if everybody is, why aren't we talking about it? Why are we going on doing all these things to prolong our lives as if it's forever with no idea, you know, way, no common way of facing this? That is what amazes me. Yes, of course I knew I was going to die.
I guess we all know we're going to die, but did you come to a greater sense of peace with it in the process of writing this book?
More in the breaks between the writing, you know?
Well, writing can feel like dying. So. Switching gears for a bit, you know, you've written for decades on income inequality, you know, famously for your essays that became Nickel and Dime, and now you run the Foundation for Economic Hardship Reporting Project, which supports work on that topic. In a way, Nickel and Dime was a harbinger for what we're seeing play out in our economy. And I'm wondering, looking back on that, what were the things that you saw then or maybe didn't even write about so much then that you think are really telling about what we're facing now?
Well, this project, the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, I created. I'm not the executive editor, thank God. But what we do is we are trying to support writers who are in great difficulty, journalists who are really struggling, which is almost all of them, but we do put a focus on people of color, people younger, people who are actually living terrible hardships or have lived terrible hardships because they know what's going on. And I am not going to come up with the ideas living in a nice apartment, you know, a middle-class lifestyle. So that's what we do. We raise money. We have taken people from great poverty to sort of fame by picking them up, making sure their first pieces get published, paying them so they can do the work. And we have a woman who was a maid for years cleaning houses and a single mom who's got her first book coming out. And it's going to be that story. And the book is called Maid. You'll see it. It's by Stephanie Land. But to me, that's the kind of immortality, you know, selfishly speaking. I'm not going to do another thing like Nickel and Dime. I'm not going to go out and do that reporting. Other people have to do it, and I want to help reproduce them. That sort of is my closure, you know.
Right. And did you feel that, you know, because that those essays, and you wrote another one on being a maid, the activities of that you know, you were really kind of talking about the pressures both economically but also in terms of people's time when they're working low-wage jobs, and I've heard you speak a little bit recently about the new, fairly new practice of like the sort of on-demand shift. And I'm wondering if you would just say a little bit about that.
Right. I've actually mentioned it in the book. You know the numbers, but more and more working class people do not have jobs with regular schedules. They are on call to show up when they're needed. So you don't know how much money you're going to go make at any time,
right,
or what your schedule will be. So what do you do about child care, transportation, all the things you have to juggle? And this, the way it came into my book now, is a source of tremendous stress. And one of the things I think really ignored in our culture, our sort of, especially, I mean, the white, upper middle class culture, is the burden on the working class, the huge burden, the physical toll it takes, the anxiety, the stress. I mean, they used to say, oh, the stress, that's for executives. No, it's for the person who's being called and told, get in here in 20 minutes and has a baby to take care of, and things like that. No wonder there is an opioid crisis in that particular demographic and spreading to other demographics. Yeah, they're in physical pain, and they're also in extreme emotional pain. And we go on as if all the health and wellness problems and so on are in the realm of socialites. So that infuriates me.
Another thing that you've written about before is the sort of, which we're seeing come back again, this sort of means testing for social insurance programs. Now Ben Carson might try and test, make sure people are working at least part-time to get public housing, and that kind of thing is back in vogue.
Yeah, that you have to have a job before you can get Medicaid. I love that. We're going to see a lot of people mowing lawns, with their canes and their walkers, too. It's just you don't want to be in public housing unless
and Medicaid. There's talk.
Yeah, and have a job. What can we say? It's 18th century, Dickensian.
Yeah. To kind of intersect these two things, you had an interesting observation about the kind of prohibition on smoking and the working class. And I'm wondering if you could just sort of tell the audience what you saw this very much as a kind of a further assault on working class people and their sort of ability to take a break
I pointed this out to your former chief editor, Lewis Lapham, many years ago. I said, the war on smoking, the crusade against smoking, looks like a war on the working class. Because who smokes? That's who smokes. Well, actually, Lewis Lapham smoked too, which may have something to do with our friendship. And he said, you've got to write about that. Well, I finally found somebody to do the writing about it, a woman whose nom de plume is June Thunderstorm, and she she's a brilliant young writer, and she took the idea. Why do people smoke? Because it eases the stress. It eases the stress because it is addictive to an extent. And if you have no other way of escaping the stress for a moment, I saw it when I worked in a restaurant and there was one big communal ashtray in the break room where people left their still burning cigarettes so they wouldn't have to relight next time they got a few seconds off to break. Because everything else you did for the boss. But this was something you did for yourself, kind of wellness in a perverse way for the working class.
You've served on the boards of two groups that have seen their ideas become more mainstream lately, and I'm just wondering if you have thoughts about that timing, both the Democratic Socialists of America and NORML, the marijuana legalization lobby. If you've been following these issues for a long time, why suddenly now is there kind of movement in those directions?
Well, I don't know about legalization of marijuana so much, but it's pretty clear that DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, took a huge leap with Trump. Thank you, Trump. He has energized the women's movement. He is a great organizer for us, I have to say. That's the clear thing. I mean, people can realize we're in deep shit. We have to be out there fighting from one way or another.
Yeah. I'm going to ask folks who want to ask Barbara some questions to come up to the microphones right here. Is this where I should? Right over here. And if you can't do that or you're... And we are recording, so... No swearing, people.
You are reporting? I mean, recording?
I guess we're being recorded. It's news to me. But anyway, come on up to the microphones, or if you're kind of stuck in the middle or otherwise unable to get up, raise your hand and we'll try and get a microphone to you.
Why don't you go up there?
Come on, don't be shy.
No, it has to be recorded.
So the first book about wellness that I read about 40 years ago was a Seventh-day Adventist book about nutrition and lifestyle called Back to Eden. And since then, of course, there are people who want to make themselves well by eating a Paleolithic diet, people who think that genetically modified foods are the source of all of our problems. And there seems to be this recurring idea that earlier in prehistory, that's when life was really good. And living in modern times is the source of all of our problems. So I just wonder if you want to say something about Eden as a trope, about there's some nostalgia for a long ago past. Is our genuine well-being in the present and the future, or is it in looking to the distant past?
I think that was directed to you, Claire.
No. I'm no religious scholar.
Huh?
No. Go ahead.
You just eat salad?
Yes, nothing but salad.
What?
I'm kidding.
Don't you know that's so girly to just eat salad?
She once gave me a little bit of business for wearing pink, so.
Well, I don't know. I don't have the information. That's what I would have to say. It is not as clear as we'd like to know how prehistoric people ate. The only impression I get, because I love to read about these things, is that they were very opportunistic. If they were on, a seashore, they ate a lot of shellfish. If they weren't, they ate a lot of animal meat and whatever plants they could gather. I think it's frustrating that we don't know more.
You talked about the fact that we're all into these wellness programs trying to keep ourselves alive and that we're all going to die, which is certainly true, and that perhaps we should be talking about that and what our common approach is. And you really kind of didn't get into what that might look like. So I wonder if you could talk about that a little.
Wait, what common approach?
Could she not hear me?
Common approach.
Well, I think it ought to be something that we are able to discuss. I don't have the answers, right? That it isn't like a mystery or left to our religions or something like that, but that, thinking about what is the important things we want to do with the time we have, that would be a discussion, for example.
But do you think that there's a need to replace or to reinvigorate collective action or activities of one kind or another, rather than, because it seems like some of the book is talking about how individualistic these pursuits are.
I think there are conversations we could have. And for me, they would center on what is the best way to spend our time. Now, some people will say sitting in doctor's office, in waiting rooms, getting new tests. Some people would be more hedonistic, and I would be with them. And some people would be saying, what is the most important thing we can do for others and for our species at this time, with the time we have left? But I think all those things could be sorted out and would be interesting discussions.
Hello, thank you so much for your book. I wish I'd read it a year and a half ago. I myself underwent very drastic surgery because they discovered a tumor in my pancreas, and I was scared to death of pancreatic cancer. I've known someone to die of it, and it's not a pretty disease. And a friendly nutritionist tried to reassure me not to go ahead because she said, well, the 50%, they say it's 50-50, you'll get pancreatic cancer if you have that tumor. She said, who are those 50%? As though everyone is the same. And partly I was also frightened. I got all the insurance lined up and I thought, if I decline to have this surgery now, I might have to pay $100,000. If I'd been in Britain, I wouldn't have been worried about having to pay, and I could have just taken a decision at my leisure. And the doctor at Stanford actually said that he estimated on the basis of a scan that it was over 50% larger than it proved to be, and it was completely benign, and there was not a single cancer cell in my body, but yet they stripped out quite a few organs just to be on the safe side. So I just wonder to what extent, you know, we have a kind of medical industrial complex which is linked up with the insurance companies as well to get those of us who can afford it through their insurance.
Oh, no, yeah. Absolutely. Thank you. I mean, I should have said that. But I have written about that and researched that going back many years. It's clear, for example, all these this unnecessary testing and screening of people over 50 is because we have Medicare. You know, we're a good market. Meanwhile, young people in this country are terribly neglected. For example, I think this is so shocking, there is an actual increase in maternal mortality now in the United States, especially among black women, especially in southern states. But they're not interesting. They may not have Medicaid. They may not have anything. Who cares about them? So, you know, all of these, you know, this is a obscenely capitalist healthcare system, which distorts everything we look at.
Well, thank you for that. And I guess we could see medicalizing wellness from a couple of decades ago. It was inevitable. That's what we do with our American healthcare system. But I do think we should also be celebrating something that some of us saw in the mid-1980s, which was this what was called healthy aging. We were going to try and mitigate or prevent some of the conditions that people are experiencing in their 40s and 50s around chronic disease, heart disease, diabetes, and try and shift that all to our 60s and 70s, which for a segment of the population, we've been successful. So here we are on the other side of that. With many of us, I'm in my 50s, but still, we have an older population than ever before. We are a graying population, and we are now in the thick of trying to sort out, well, what does that mean for us, particularly with income inequality, where many of us can't retire or even think about it. And I'm wondering if that's the big narrative here, is that what do we do when we're now older than we thought we'd be, and we're all in it together?
I think that's a really interesting point that you raise, that now that we have so many people who have gone through this medicalization of alternative care, that now we're with people in their 60s and 70s trying to figure out how to integrate this into that phase of their life is one of the things she raised.
Alternative forms of care.
But both. Also, uh-huh. Just with income inequality coming in, that kind of creates...
Well, you know, one of the things that's going on so rapidly is the conversion of ordinary medical practices into concierge practices. You've seen it, everybody's seen it. The doctor wants to weed out his non-rich patients. So he or she says, now you have to pay $1,500 in addition to whatever the insurance company will pay me just to get in the door. So there's a tremendous weeding out everywhere going on. So a lot of us may at some point be left waiting for one of those, you know, trucks that goes along to rural areas with a dentist in it and a physician's assistant and so on, because this is not working.
Hi. I work in disability communities, and I'm really interested in ways that we can be building better alliances across communities because, you know, you talk about the working class people that are being burned out from these jobs, and they end up in my community. And yet, when we start to try to have conversations between disabled and non-disabled communities about these issues, I'm freaking out because I see our people dying from medical gatekeeping. We're forced to those doctor appointments just to get the medicines we need to survive, or even just to get housing. I have to get a doctor's note to ride to get a disabled bus pass, for example. And I'm wondering what you see as places where we could be building better connections and conversations with each other.
Across class. Well, that's a huge question and a powerful one. I'm trying. I think we all have to try. I mean, I'm actually situated in a family situation, which is somewhat mixed class. So that's a help. But we have so much in common. I mean, me, say, and my truck driver friend, who's in real life, who voted for Trump. We have a lot in common. We've had long discussions about many things. We haven't talked for a little while, but you know, it's we have to repair those relationships that we have. And if you think about them, we all have some of them. I have to mention a billboard I saw while I was being driven in a car service from the airport, SFO, to San Francisco. There was a giant billboard that I think said, it said, you are a leader. You are an entrepreneur. You are a change maker. You are like a master of the universe. You are not a driver. It was a billboard for Uber appealing to the upper class about why you need to be driven rather than driving. And I had a very interesting discussion about that with the driver of my car. You know, the arrogance, the constant contempt working class people are subjected to. It must make you sick, you know, personally feel, I'm sure, very stressed out each day.
Hi, I have great appreciation of your work since the 70s of witches, midwives, and nurses, when I remember that early stage. I go back that far.
Is Deirdre English here? Anyway. The co-author of Witches, Nurses, and Midwives? Oh, well.
Anyway, I'm a little perplexed, but I hear very much of some of what you're saying about the medicalization of health and the denial of aging and doing everything you can, especially if you're affluent, have wealth, to keep our bodies together from a natural process. So I can greatly appreciate that. One of the last times I was at the doctor, and she's like, you have to have this shot, and you have to have this shot, and you have to your 10-year colonoscopy, and I'm like, no, I don't want all this, leave me alone, I don't think some of it's so good for me. So I hear that, and just a couple of weeks ago, I had to go for a follow-up mammogram, and I said, no, I don't want to go. My husband was just diagnosed with prostate cancer. I don't want that. They always make me go back. What the heck? Well, 4 letters later and 4 calls, I did go back. I do have breast cancer, and I'm really glad that this system of mammograms is in place because I wouldn't know it. Now, I totally agree. Some of what you're saying is like, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole that somebody says, chemo might be too much for me because it just might be too much for me. And I have to decide that based on, you know, all the information I can get and not just corralled. But I'm also, I guess that's sort of a balance I'm saying about some of what you're saying and, you know, sort of the continuum. Yeah, no, so when you said, for example, I'll take it away from breast cancer, you said, you know, there's no poisons in our food. There are poisons in our food. And poor people and working class people eat shittier food, and it does make them sicker. And food deserts and things, as you well know, are real realities. So it's like for us to not buy into the narcissistic, affluent health thing, but also recognize how much and how many people in this country do not have access to good, healthy food and screening that might be helpful to them. I guess I want to ask you about that dimension.
I knew it would happen. I knew it was coming. I'll tell you one major thing. Reason I hate the constant dietary fads we're subjected to is that in the 90s it was no fat, low fat, no fat. All you heard it everywhere. That I think directly contributed to the obesity epidemic, because people just went from fat, from French fries, for example, to low-fat chocolate chip cookies and things. They substituted carbs and got fat. We do not know what is the right proportion of these different things to eat. That said, I am pretty sure that a lot of working class people are eating is bad for them in the sense that they're going to be hungry again in 2 hours. If your lunch, and I've seen this often, in 7-Eleven or whatever your convenience store would be, is a bag of chips and a can of bull, what is it?
Red Bull,
I'm sorry. That's not going to last you long. Your blood sugar is going to rise and it's going to collapse. So for that practical reason, I would say do not eat that. Whether anything prolongs or shortens life, we're not so sure.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of echo something that was asked, because I would sort of ask it in a different way. I was really looking at this as kind of a disability event, because my understanding of like the disability community and the lens of critiquing like ableism and healthism is quite broad. And then when you were sort of talking about like doctors and relationships, like Corbett who spoke, I was thinking, well, the answer to that is obvious. Like, you might need that doctor for something. You might need a form, you might need a letter, you might need something to get the benefits that you need to live. And then that was kind of like, okay, so there's this separation of like having this critique of the medical industrial complex and being a progressive, but still being, I guess, sort of relatively healthy or able-bodied identified. So I'm wondering, like, if there is something that we can do within our communities or something that can happen more broadly where people can see those issues as kind of being more along the same continuum. Do you know what I mean? Like, the issues that happen in the disability community, they're very much seen as disability issues, and they don't really make it out to the mainstream unless it's looked at as affecting like people that consider themselves to be relatively healthy or able-bodied, who might right. just like sometimes get sick. So I'm wondering again, like, what your advice would be or what your thoughts would be around bridging that gap of understanding.
Well, they say there's not a clear line between the disability community and the abled community. Look at me, I have a cane. I went from being fully abled in a few years to being somewhat disabled. You know, being very nervous about stairs and all the kinds of things. I'm not, you know, never been in a walker, but there isn't, what I learned is that there's not a clear distinction. And one of the things that happens as you get older is you do develop what could be called disabilities in vision, hearing, mobility, everything else. So I think we have to acknowledge that and not think of the disability community as this like special group of people that are different from everybody else. Does that help?
That affect this small group of people. So I was just wondering if you had tips around
broadening that understanding. I would say what I just said to them.
Okay.
You know, come on, wake up. We're all on the verge of disability. I hate to say that, but I mean, it's true. One disability, or you know, its vision begins in your, problems begin in your 40s. All of these things continue. I am a living testament to these problems.
Yeah, I have to agree with the macro, you know, picture that you're painting, that there's a lot of over-testing, whether the test itself is risky, like mammogram or colonoscopy that was mentioned, and there's also the, you know, the risk of over-treatment. But, you know, I think making a general statement about over-testing really... I have a problem with it. And the problem is that there are various individuals that should be tested. For example, if you have a family history of osteoporosis, you should be tested to have a bone density exam. And so what I'm afraid of is people don't like these tests, and they don't like to go in to see doctors, and it costs money. So you'll say, well, the hell with it. I just won't test, even though from that particular individual, the risk-reward, well, it weighs... for the reward. And I think there are other kinds of tests where there's really no risk in the test itself. There's no risk of overtreatment. For example, a vitamin D test, which is really simple, or a thyroid test, which is very simple, and the treatment is an extremely inexpensive pill. So what I'm the problem I'm having is people will take this general idea that tests are bad, and this is kind of what the women said right before me, from your book. I haven't read it, so I can't, you know, it may not be that generalized.
Yeah, I'm not saying
I guess you got my point.
I'm not saying all tests are bad, and that not everybody should, and that everybody should stop. Here's why I stopped. I would one quick point, because you make a lot of good points here, is that thyroid testing. They kind of went crazy with that in the early part of the OOs, and in some countries, I think it was Korea, South Korea, got up to a 90% rate of unnecessary thyroid surgery as a result of all the testing. High rates of unnecessary thyroid surgery is for women in other countries, nowhere as big as high as South Korea, but everyone that you can mention. Osteoporosis, do we have a cure for that? No, we have a drug called Fosamax, which has one little problem, that it can cause bone fractures. So that's what we're trying to avoid, right? So I'm just saying, I would argue with you step by step about each test, but I am not giving you a blanket objection. If you have a family history or something, might well be a good idea.
I understand that wellness can go to ridiculous extremes of self-care and over-testing, but I wanted to piggyback on an earlier question about the shift in medicine as people are living longer. And I'm wondering if it's not so much the fear of death, but the fear of aging. And many people I know are not afraid of sudden death, but rather of the process of aging, the loss of mobility, all kinds of losses. And then if you add in on that, or add to that, how many people as they get older have chronic autoimmune disorders, heart conditions, etc., then I think people do get very motivated to read medical newsletters and on and on, to have some sense that they're going to do something that's going to make the aging process one in which where they can do as much as they can and be as functional as possible. And I guess everybody, most of us can't really always transcend our personal dilemmas, but as somebody who was hit with a barrage of diagnoses in the last 5 or 6 years, I noticed that my interest in medical newsletters has grown. Even though I worked for an HMO for a quarter of a century. So anyway, I just wanted to flag that I think this the whole aging process, and that I think when people have very active lives, it's hard to hold on to what the experience is of for people who have very limited or limited mobility in their aging.
Right, absolutely, I agree with you. I'm experiencing some of this. I can't hike the way I used to, but I'm gonna get better though. I'm working on it. But it's a matter of, at some point, understanding that we do not control this, you know, and stop kind of devoting so much attention to trying to control this. You know, one of the things I often think about in my own control efforts, like in the gym, is that it's partly because I cannot control what goes on in the world. I cannot figure out anything to do about the latest Trump tweet or whatever. But I do have some control over the strength of my quadriceps. That is my zone of control. And I understand that, and we're all striving for something like that.
Hi, I had a follow-up question about means testing, and also what you talked about in terms of stress in the working class. Do you have an opinion on universal basic income?
Anybody?
Universal basic income.
Oh, yes. All for it. Of course. But it has to be high enough. Yes, absolutely.
Question? Maybe this is our couple more questions. We should probably round up.
Okay. Say it again. Should I speak next? Oh, okay. I would like to go back to this issue of the disability community and the rest of us. And one of the things that we used to talk about a lot was that old people have a lot in common with disabled people. But old people don't want to be called disabled, and they don't realize we know a lot, especially if we've been living with a disability for a long time. And there was a woman who asked, so where do we go from here? Okay. And I think part of this is realize, number one, that getting old is very stressful. It doesn't matter who you are or what you are, aging is really a tense period. You don't know what the heck's going to happen to you. You don't know what, you know, do I do this? Is that something? You know, what's going to happen to me? And I think that one of the things that the disability community has discovered is peer support. And that's a really, really important thing for us as old people who are facing all sorts of chronic conditions and disabilities to talk to each other and say, we can support each other and tell each other how we survive. The disability community has lots and lots of ways to solve problems. Getting a van so you can have a scooter. Using public transportation and learning how to do it. Taking advantage of your independent living center to find out stuff. It's cool. We are cool. We know a lot of stuff about how to live with disability and mental illness as well as physical illness. There's a lot of mental illness in the aging community, and everybody just kind of sticks their nose up, you know, oh God, she's so old and she's like a baby and I can't take over, you know. So I really do think that what we need to be pushing for is support among old people to help each other get through this period of, we're the oldest group of people living now in the world. That's what happened. And that's what medicine got us here. And, you know, that's great. But now, what are we going to do when we're 80 and 90 and 100 years old? How are we going to get over this? How are we going to deal with it without blaming ourselves that we didn't do something that saved us from something? You know, that we can't start keep feeling guilty about the stuff we're not doing.
That's a really excellent point.
Excellent. Yeah. Yeah. You have a lot to teach.
Mm-hmm. I have a lot to learn. I want to push back a little on the same question about disability. I think that, Barbara, you missed the point that people with disabilities who confront disability at a younger age don't have the option to not go to the doctor, don't have the option to not develop a personal ongoing relationship with the doctor, because the doctor is the gateway to benefits. We don't have socialism. We don't have, in this country, we have stingy and means-tested and doctor-gate-weighted public benefits for survival. So people with disabilities can't be so cavalier about not going to the doctor.
Well, yes, they should not be such an imposing gateway to so many things that people basically need, because doctors are expensive, for one thing. There has to be a better gateway to getting your, you know, BART pass for the handicapped and so on. It doesn't have to be an MD. I didn't anticipate the conversation going in this direction, but I fear a little bit that this thing about the disability community versus everybody else and people who just come into disability recently because of age sounds to me a little bit about like some of the debates over the trans community, don't you think? That, you know, you can't be a real woman if you haven't been a real woman all along. If you haven't, you know, experienced menstruation and childbirth, you can't be a woman. I would be a little more inclusively inclined. You know, I'm totally, in terms of the trans issue, yeah, you're a woman, fine with me. Come right on into the restroom. But I don't want you to become more exclusive as a, you know, a disability rights community, and not say, look, we are the future of everybody.
Well, it's,
as this woman said, we, you know, we know things, we lead the way.
It seems to me that just as a matter of strength in numbers and lobbying, that it's a really interesting thing to think about how the community of seniors and the community of people who have been disabled for longer than being a senior could really team up and have political clout. I mean, I think we've seen that in some of the protests on Capitol Hill and in other cases. So if that continues, where people really form alliances based on the access to the healthcare that they want and need, I think that could be really powerful.
So this is more in the nature of like something I found out by going to visit my doctor. And I got to this point maybe a couple of years ago where, you know, I just had to check in and go like, you know, I got all these things going wrong with me that everybody's my age has. So it's like totally I'm accepting of all of that. But then you have certain problems. That's like, how do I quit smoking? And he goes, like, I have a magic bullet I can give you. It's like, really? I don't have to struggle? What is that? Oh, it's a medication called Chantix, and it has a 90% success ratio, and you get the most amazing dreams you'll ever have in your life. And I did it, and I'm a salesman for Chantix. But then, so, I'm not, but it did work, and it's worth knowing about if you have my problem. So I have this other problem that is universal, that's apropos of your discussion tonight, and I go, you know, is there, if the worst thing happens, you know, if I get the big C, and I elect to opt out, what are my options? And he goes, I can kill you. And I didn't know that. He said, yeah, as a doctor in California, I can kill you. I can give you two little vials, and you take one and you go to sleep. But after you take that, you have to commit, you know, because it's like jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. You know, once you've jumped, that's it. But I mean, it had this very strange, it enlightened me. It gave me an option for something that I didn't know exist. And I just want to share that and any thoughts you have on the matter.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth knowing that in California, the law is that it has to be a terminal illness, and there are other provisions. So there's a fairly limited, but much more expansive than it used to be, physician-assisted suicide law in the books for the past year about.
Thanks so much for this. It seems to me that... thank you. It seems to me a lot of the concern about testing in this country and over-testing in this country is based around the idea that Medicare and similar kinds of systems have systemic incentives that lead to these kinds of things. But of course, there are other parts of the world where these incentives work quite differently. The Canadian Medicare system is quite different. The NHS in the UK is quite different, as previous speakers have pointed to. And I'm wondering if you think... Do those systems work differently? This is a question of ignorance. In terms of over-testing, would you have made a different decision if you lived in London or in Toronto to avoid this kind of testing?
And what choices of living
in the UK or Canada, would you have made a different decision?
Would I make a different decision? Well, I don't think so. Actually, the comparison I make in my mind is like to rural Uganda. And I say to the doctor, is this something you would do routinely in rural Uganda? Oh, no, they couldn't afford it. I said, well, then I don't want to do it either. It doesn't, if it's important and it's life-saving, let's do it worldwide. Let's do it for everybody. Otherwise, uh-uh.
Thank you.
I think this is our last question, sir. Okay, two more.
Great. Okay. Am I speaking right into it? Yeah. So somehow it seems like I've avoided all kinds of unnecessary operations sort of successfully, but I wanted to ask you what you thought about cataracts, about a cataract operation, whether that's something you need to have or whether you should just say no to it.
Cataracts.
Oh, yeah. I'm not resisting treatment. As I said to my prospective doctor, I will come to you with a problem. Just don't go looking for them. Yeah, sure, they can do great things. But let us find them, all right?
My parents both just had cataract surgery, and they're ecstatic about it. Sending help.
Okay, can you hear me? Yeah, when and if you go see your doctor by the end of the year, even if you've had a shingle shot, and shingles is a terrible recurrence of a virus that can cause really bad pain. It's only 50% effective. And there's a new injection called Shingrix. It's been approved by the FDA. You can't get it yet. It's not available in this country much. But by the end of the year, it will be. It's been approved. And you ought to talk to your doctor about it if you go again. And if you happen to have, if you ever go see your doctor again and ask him about something routine, this is a preventative thing. It's not going to cure anything you've currently got. And if you were a young, if you ever, as a young person, injected drugs or you had a transfusion before 1970, or you ever had HIV, you might want to get tested for hepatitis C if you see your doctor again, if you ever go again. Because if you have hepatitis C, now there's a treatment that's very expensive, really difficult, not difficult, and it really works. So there are things, and if you're a young person, you might want to get an HPV shot so you don't have any risk of...
Absolutely.
So there are things you might want to see your doctor for.
Right. I have campaigned all my life for necessary testing, like lead poisoning testing for children who live in, shoddy buildings. There are so many kinds of testing that are important, HIV testing. Not the silly looking for some, profits to mine from a 65-year-old patient.
But I think your point about how much vaccines can prevent, I'll just put in my plug for stay strong with vaccines, the sort of anti-vax movement. Now we're trying to get it to pets. It's crazy. Sorry about that. Okay, I'd like to thank Barbara so much for being here. Thank you all for a really interesting discussion. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.